Acclaimed as the 21st century John le Carré, Mick Herron is the award-winning author of the Slough House series of spy thrillers, which have recently been adapted for an Apple TV series featuring Gary Oldman as the disgraced Cold War veteran Jackson Lamb. That character's main attributes are smoking, breaking wind, using foul language as often as possible, necking whiskey, and not caring a hoot about the poor rejects unlucky enough to call him their boss. Mick Herron's latest novel in the series of Slough House books is called Bad Actors, and delighted to be joined by Mick on the programme this evening. What on earth was the attraction in a character like Jackson Lamb, I wonder, Mick?
I think you've just listed them all, frankly, Sean.
Was there any kind of real-life model in your mind for this, or is he a wonderful creation of the imagination?
Oh, the imagination. Although, not entirely my own imagination. I mean, whenever you try to create a character like this, you're inevitably going to be drawing on archetypes. So there are, you know, similar characters in both in detective fiction and in classical fiction that you could draw Lamb's antecedents from.
And you know, one of the comparisons that's often made, I mentioned it in the introduction, references between your writing and that of John le Carré. And when we get a television series that has Gary Oldman playing the character of Jackson Lamb, of course we are going to think of Gary Oldman as George Smiley in Tinker, Tailor, Soldier, Spy. But you couldn't get two different characters, really, could you, than Smiley and Lamb? Was that in your mind in any way, creating a kind of antidote to that calm type of spy that we get from le Carré in that particular novel and film?
Smiley was never in my mind when I created Lamb, although I can easily see why people think of Lamb as the antithesis of George Smiley. I think if I were capable of creating a character like Smiley and writing books in the key that le Carré wrote, I would do so. But I'm not as good as him, and therefore I make a virtue of my own limitations, and I rely on the grotesque and sometimes bordering on caricature, I suppose, although all my characters are sincerely meant, I have to say.
And when you heard that Gary Oldman was cast then in the television series, and you, I presume you had seen Tinker, Tailor, Soldier, Spy and had seen his version of Smiley, did that tickle your fancy in that respect, or what were your thoughts on it?
I had to stop and lean against a wall. I was completely blown away when I heard that he was going to play the part, and have been thoroughly delighted by everything he's done since. He's thrown himself into this role, is really enjoying doing it, and the degree to which he is drawing on his own interpretation of Smiley, I wouldn't like to say. I often think that he's perhaps drawing a bit more on his interpretation of Sid Vicious from his very early film, Sid and Nancy.
There are certainly possibly more comparisons to be made there, for sure. Let's talk about Slough House and the place in which Jackson Lamb finds himself in the whole series. Even the name Slough House and Slow Horses, which is the title of the television series, the title of the first novel in your series, Slow Horses, gives us a sense that the people here, they're not the very top of the pile, really, are they?
They are not. The slow horses themselves are the failures, the incompetents, or those with personal issues of one sort or another, which has rendered them unfit for service in the top ranks of the intelligence service. So they're sent off to this, what I describe as an administrative oubliette, where they're given a lot of mundane, dull tasks to do in the hope that they will come to their senses and quit and stop being a nuisance. But because of the type of people they are, they want to hang on. They all believe that there's redemption somewhere for them, but there isn't.
Yeah, I mean, when you pick in many ways, you pick failures then as the central characters for the novel. What kind of challenges does that put up to you? And particularly in the case of Jackson Lamb, you know, how much is it a failure that we're talking about here? Or is he seen as a failure by other people rather than in his own mind?
I don't think Lamb himself is a failure. Slough House is what he wanted. It's I thought stated quite clearly, but perhaps just merely hinted broadly at the end of Slow Horses, that Slough House was his reward for deeds that he'd rather draw a veil over. And he would quite happily spend the rest of his life just sitting in his office with his feet on his desk, drinking and smoking and breaking wind, as you say. He had a successful career prior to later life, although I've never explored that in any depth. And so he's where he wants to be. It's everybody else who doesn't want to be there.
Where do we find him then in Bad Actors, in the latest novel?
Pretty much where he's always been. He's up in his office with his shoes off and holes in his socks. Although the structure of the novel is such that you discover halfway through that he has been up to things a few days previously before the novel opened. Mm. So he's generally the smartest person in the room, although he hides it very well. And that's where he is in Bad Actors as well.
I suppose maybe if we give a definition, or you give me your definition of what a bad actor is, because a bad actor in the spy sense of the word, obviously, because it has so many ironic sides to it.
It's a phrase I've been using for quite a while in the novels, and I've long intended it to be a title. The fact that it happens to be the title of the book that comes out just as the TV series starts streaming is pure coincidence, I assure you. Bad actors are simply those of malign intent. And in the terms of the novel, it's particularly applied towards political bad actors, not necessarily elected representatives of the people, but those who've managed to find themselves in positions of unelected power and generally have malign motives, in as much as they're not working for the national good, they're working for their own gratification.
And in the case of bad actors, the character we're talking about in that case is this Anthony Sparrow fellow.
I'm glad to say he bears no resemblance to anyone we've seen on the political scene here in the UK for quite some years, because it would be a terrible thought to have someone of that nature in anywhere near the seat of power.
We have nobody at all who resembles that in recent times. Nobody at all who advised a prime minister who loves the classics, who likes using florid language and is often noted for his buffoonery. And I'm talking about the fictional prime minister across your books, of course.
I have occasionally drawn inspiration from figures in public life, but I wouldn't overstate that. I mean, the character I'm writing about is quite short. And the person you're referring to is quite tall. So there's an obvious disparity between, you know, the fiction and reality here.
But, you know, obviously irony and satire is what's going on in the book to a large extent, Mick. And we do get this this prime minister character being advised by this bad actor, if you like. And it all links into a Cold War type of situation. I don't want to go into the ins and outs of that. It's too confusing for the listener who hasn't read the book, and also it gives too much away. But there definitely is a sense that there are those in Russia who perhaps are aware of the ailing Vladimir Putin, or the premier that is not named in your book. And are you hopeful, as the book seems to suggest, that there are those in Russia who feel that perhaps it's time to do something about the premier at the head of their country?
Obviously, I had no idea that the events we've seen unfolding over the past 3 months were going to happen. But I had no doubt that Putin was, you know, well, I think I call him a psychopath in the novel, and this has been borne out by events. There's a comment to the effect that as he nears the end of his reign, he'll see blood running in the gutters. And this is not something I wanted to see happen in real life, but it's what I felt. The head of the intelligence service in my book, who uses those words, that's what she would have thought. And she was perfectly correct. I do think there's a possibility that he won't be there much longer. But maybe that's because we're being encouraged to think that way by certain elements of the press here. I mean, I hope they're right. I hope they're right.
The other side of that is, and this comes to the very serious intent of the novels, because while I find myself at several points during the piece, certainly laughing at the behaviours of various characters, I was also kind of taken aback by things like the waterproof protocol. Could you explain that to us within the context of the novel?
Within the context of the novel, the waterproof protocol is a sort of extreme redaction whereby people can be removed from view, I suppose. People can just be disappeared, I suppose, is the word that used to be used. And this is, in my books, it's a tool of the intelligence service. It's a tool of the security service as a way of getting rid of people that they can't otherwise manage. So, in fact, I should say this, it's something that's suspected rather than verified in the books. It's suspected that this is what they're doing.
But it's a tool of the intelligence services right across the board, and particularly in this case of the intelligence services in Britain. It's another thing that comes through the book, that perhaps those who are the greatest enemies are the enemies within rather than the enemies from elsewhere.
I do lean on that quite a lot throughout the series, I have to say. But I should stress that this whole waterproof thing is imaginary. You know, I have invented it for the purpose of the books. Often the enemy does seem to be within, but it's largely down to bureaucratic fumbling and incompetence rather than anything else. Often my characters end up chasing each other's tails in ever-decreasing circles, largely because I'd like to take a sort of human view of these large organisations. They are run by people who have their own agendas, their own ambitions, their own weaknesses. And these are the things that I like to draw on when I'm creating the plots, why things go wrong and what sort of motives underlie the official aims of the organisations.
I want to listen to a clip from the television series, if I could. And this, to give a context here, we're listening to two characters. The Gary Oldman character is Jackson Lamb, and River Cartwright, a character played by Jack Loudon, who got himself into a bit of trouble by acting in the wrong way in a training exercise. Let's have a listen to how Gary Oldman as Jackson Lamb treats this, really his inferior in his mind, and the strong language, as we might expect, from Jackson Lamb in the midst of all of this.
Is it me, or did all the fun go out of everything around 1979?
Are we looking for something, or are we just wanting him to know that we're looking at him?
It's we. There is no we. It's just me telling you what to do.
OK, do you want to tell me to put him under surveillance?
Who?
Hobden.
What, you would be doing the surveillance?
Yeah.
You?
Yeah.
Well, that's an interesting proposition, considering the last time you were given any sort of responsibility. A load of innocent people got blown to bits.
There it is.
Oh, well, I'm sorry you find it so tiresome, Cartwright, but it's not the social faux pas you seem to think it was. You didn't break wind during someone's wedding vows. What was it? 149 dead, 212 injured. 3 million in damages, half a billion in lost revenue.
It was a training exercise.
If a pilot crashes a simulator, he doesn't then brush it off and go, well, sorry, it was a fucking exercise, and then expect to be put behind the wheel of a 747.
It's not the same thing.
No, it's worse. You tit.
Gary Oldman as Jackson Lamb, River Cartwright played by Jack Loudon, in a scene there from Slow Horses, which is the television series based on the Mick Herron novel, the Slough House series of spy thrillers. Mick speaking to us this evening about the latest of those novels, Bad Actors. But I wanted to go back to that very early, I think it's the very first episode of the series, and obviously from the very early books as well that comes, Mick. Seeing the characters alive, if you like, on the screen, what does that do to the writing of them now, you know, when it comes to writing the latest novels further down the line for you?
Well, when I wrote Bad Actors, I knew who was playing the parts, most of the parts in the TV series. I'd watched, I'd been on set a few days, I'd watched them doing it, I'd seen little clips, and I don't think it affected the writing of Bad Actors at all. But having said that, two things. One is I'd probably not the best judge of whether that's happening or not. But mostly I want to say, if I did find myself leaning on these actors' renditions of the character, it wouldn't bother me in the slightest. They're all embodying the characters that that are in the books so beautifully that, you know, they would be a visual aid rather than anything else. Mm. With those particular two actors, I mean, Jackson Lamb has always been a voice in my head rather than an image in front of me. But, River Cartwright's one of the few characters whom I sort of had a picture of, whom I knew what he looked like, and Jack Loudon is absolutely nailed on for that part. He really looks like the river in my head, and he sounds like him, and I think he's just playing it wonderfully.
Yes, it's extraordinary that should happen in that transfer from page to screen, because it isn't always that way. Obviously, what about, I think there's a second series of Slow Horses. It's already been filmed, and more TV adaptations on the way. How involved are you in all of that, or do you stand back from it?
I'm a bit involved. I'm not wholly involved. I'll be in the writer's room tomorrow. We're going to start talking about Spook Street, the fourth book in the series. I'll be there when the for much of the time when the sequencing of the series is being prepared. So, you know, what how it happens, how the story breaks down scene by scene and episode by episode. And then these writers will go off and write dialogue for those episodes.
Clearly, you're enjoying that that interaction between the page and the screen.
I am. In a way, it surprises me because I've never been collaborative as far as creative work goes, and I thought I'd find it very difficult. But the writers and the producers are all so committed to making the series as much like the books as possible that I'm finding it really energising. They're treating the characters and the source material with great respect, more respect than I would necessarily require, I have to say. So I'm finding it, I'm having a great deal of fun, yeah.
Well, thanks for speaking with us this evening, Mick. That's Mick Herron. And the latest novel in the Slough House series is called Bad Actors. It's published by Baskerville. And of course, the series is available. It's called Slow Horses. It's available on Apple TV. It's the second week of May, and for cinema lovers the world over, that can only mean one thing. The Cannes Film Festival is now in its 75th edition. Besides celebrating cinema for three quarters of a century, it has long since offered fashion designers the opportunity to dress the stars when they walk that red carpet and up those famed steps. But fashion has always been an integral part of filmmaking. Let's have a listen.
When you shop for summer clothes, think pink.
What do you think?
Well,
I will rephrase the question.
Like you.
You like it?
Yes, I like it.
Think pink. Forget that Dior says black and rust. Think pink. Who cares if the new look has no bust?
Miss Doolittle, you look beautiful.
Thank you, Colonel Pickering.
Don't you think so, Higgins? Not bad. Not bad at all.
I just got an invitation through the mail. Your presence requested this evening is formal. Top hat, white tie, and tail. Nothing now could take the wind out of my sails. 'Cause I'm invited to step out this evening. Top hat, white tie, and tail. Oh, I'm putting on the top hat. Tying up my white tie. Brushing off my tail.
Seriously? I actually have a way normal life for a teenage girl. I mean, I get up, I brush my teeth, and I pick out my school clothes.
They do it over there, but we don't do it here.
There you go. Films in that montage were, of course, Clueless with Alicia Silverstone, Top Hat with Fred Astaire, Rear Window with Jimmy Stewart and Grace Kelly, My Fair Lady with Audrey Hepburn, Wilfred Hyde White and Rex Harrison, and Kay Kendall in Funny Face. Stephen Benedict is with me now, and he's been looking at the importance of clothes and fashion in film and how its role has evolved over the years. But first, Miranda Priestly, fashion editor supreme, and of course Meryl Streep's character in The Devil Wears Prada, throws some light on something that some of us don't even notice.
You go to your closet and you select, I don't know, that lumpy blue sweater, for instance, because you're trying to tell the world that you take yourself too seriously to care about what you put on your back. But what you don't know is that that sweater is not just blue, it's not turquoise, it's not lapis, it's actually cerulean. And you're also blithely unaware of the fact that in 2002, Oscar de la Renta did a collection of cerulean gowns. And then I think it was Yves Saint Laurent, wasn't it, who showed cerulean military jackets? I think we need a jacket here. Mm. And then cerulean quickly showed up in the collections of eight different designers. And then it filtered down through the department stores and then trickled on down into some tragic casual corner where you no doubt fished it out of some clearance bin. However, that blue represents millions of dollars and countless jobs. And it's sort of comical how you think that you've made a choice that exempts you from the fashion industry when in fact you're wearing a sweater that was selected for you by the people in this room from a pile of stuff.
Meryl Streep as Miranda Priestly there in The Devil Wears Prada. Miranda Parisi would be the first one to point out to me that it is in fact the third week of May, Sean, not the second week of May, as I seem to think. Stephen Bennett, who's with me in studio, when we apply what Miranda Priestley said there about fashion, when we apply that to film costumes, she is correct. Costume is never actually just stuff. There's a lot more really at play. Costume does more than just dress a character.
Oh, absolutely. You know, but the funny thing is, I mean, for a long time, in the early part of the cinema, from about the 1890s until the 1930s, it was quite common for actors to wear their own clothes on screen. Okay, it's hard to fathom, but until the 1930s, Fred Astaire and Cary Grant wore their own suits. Now, they're tailored suits and they're perfectly cut and measured by their personal tailors.
And I suppose in the case of somebody like Fred Astaire, we heard top hat there, yes, it's going to be the tux and, the, you know, there's exactly, not a lot you can do with that other than it's a black and white suit, off you go.
That's right. But by that stage, the costumers were bought in. But in the early days of cinema, you know, it was quite common that the casting call would come in and the actor who would actually dressed best for the part, they literally looked the part, would get the part. And then sometimes an actor would come in and they'd audition and then the producer would tell them, we don't really think there's a part for you in this picture, but we do like your hat, so we'd like to rent that. So, you know, it was a gradual thing that costumes became important. At the beginning, it literally wasn't. It was literally the actors and the faces on screen in front of the camera. That's what sold the story. But you're right. Costume designers are storytellers.
Well, I mean, no less a man than Shakespeare told us way back, didn't he, that apparel often telleth the man. So give us an example of how a costume is more than just the clothes the characters wear, where the clothes help us, you know, where they tell us as much about the character as the character speaking does.
Okay, I think we look at Gone with the Wind. Okay, in the second half of the film, this is after the Civil War has ended, Scarlett O'Hara's family, they're facing financial ruin, and Scarlett hatches a devilish plan to go to Rhett Butler, and he will give her the money to bail out the family. But the thing is, she's nothing good to wear. And so what she does is she tears down the emerald green velvet curtains from the house, and she has Mammy, played by Hattie McDaniel, refashion them into the gown. Now, the green curtains had been selected by her late mother, Ellen. But she had died during the Civil War of typhoid. So what's happening here is Scarlett is really in character because she's actually tearing down the family heritage to save it. Okay.
Right.
So, but there's something else going on as well, which I think is very important to note. We can see her desecrating the family heritage and it's pulling on the heartstrings.
Yes,
it's very,
yes,
very emotional. But that hysterical tone, for me, Sean, distracts us what's really going on. Scarlett's family are slave owners. And the family estate isn't an estate, it's actually a slave plantation. And so, you know, the title of the film is bemoaning the Gone with the Wind is bemoaning or lamenting the loss of that culture. And it makes it look very, very glamorous. And that's the reason why the film is so popular, is because it looked very glamorous.
Yeah. But glamour, I mean, it wasn't new. It's always been very important in terms of Hollywood. You mentioned Cary Grant and Fred Astaire.
Yeah.
Very glamorous, I'm sure, in their own tailored suits.
Yeah.
But when did glamour become important in terms of costume design? Or is it always glamour?
It's no, not, I think it really upped the ante in the 30s. Because that was the establishment of the golden age of Hollywood. That was the studio system.
So give me a couple
through.
Of films.
Well,
that
you
existed.
Have films like The Philadelphia Story, which is about, you know, blue stocking America. You've also got Anna Karenina. This is the 1935 version. Starring Greta Garbo. You've also got Now Voyager starting Betty Davis. And, you know, some actors actually had it written into their contract, like Marlene Dietrich, who was working at Paramount Pictures. She had it written into her contract that only a specific designer could dress for her.
I was going to say that. You talked about actors having their own costumes. It did get to the point then when actors would have their own stylists who would
yes.
be aware of how to dress that person, no matter what the character was they were playing.
Oh, yeah. I mean, look, you had Audrey Hepburn and Givenchy. You know, that was in the 50s. But the thing is that you also had the establishment of really, really great designers. And probably the most famous one is Edith Head. She had a career that spanned six decades. She won 8 Oscars, 35 nominations. And she was a very, very striking figure. She was very diminutive. She had a short black bob haircut and she wore large, thick black rimmed glasses with purple tints on the lenses. So when she was designing, she knew what the costume would look like in black and white. If that sounds familiar, if you've seen The Incredibles, Edna Mode Edith Head.
Right, we might come back to that. You've talked about Hitchcock pictures and Joan Fontaine, Ingrid Bergman, Kim Novak. Grace Kelly in Rear Window and To Catch a Thief. fashion model. She was actually playing a model in Rear Window. Does that confuse the design issue?
No, I think it actually enhanced it because she plays Lisa Carol Fremont and she introduces herself with the dress that she wore that night. But if you can, Sean, just permit me to move away from the glamour.
I was going to say it wasn't always glamour because if you're going to dress a character who's not a glamorous character, you have to address them.
You've got to go down.
Accordingly.
And the example I'd want to give is actually from a Hitchcock picture, Psycho. And I'm mentioning this because it didn't break the mold, but it showed how it could actually be operated. Mm. Because what he did was he decided not to work with Edith Head. He'd collaborated with her many, many times before, but he decided not to work with her on this picture. So he employed a complete novice, a lady called Helen Colvick. She had never had a screen credit before. And he gave her an instruction. I don't want you to design the costumes. I want you to choose them. So take Janet Leigh here, go down to the department store and choose something off the rack that a character like Marion Crane as a secretary could afford. So she bought her two suits, but more importantly, and this is again as costume as character, she bought her a white bra and a white slip and a black slip. And the opening scene, we see Janet Leigh wearing a white bra and a white slip. And then after the robbery, we see her wearing a black bra and a black slip.
Character
revelation, exactly. Yeah, so that's
changed fundamentally, I suppose. But that idea of dressing down as well, and I suppose dressing maybe in a more practical fashion, links into society post Second World War. Women going into the workforce and wearing clothes that were necessary if you were going to be working in a factory, a munitions factory, or whatever it was.
Yeah, I think over the last century, fashion has moved. I mean, not high street, not sort of haute couture, but fashion has become much more functional as opposed to glamorous. You know, we're dressing for comfort now. And I think a movie that typifies that is Annie Hall, Woody Allen's comedy from 1977, starring Diane Keaton in the title role. The great thing about that is every single shred of clothing that she wore in that film was from her own real wardrobe in real life.
Yeah, but Diane Keaton can wear a black bag and it'll look great on her, it has to be said.
But also then it's the influence that she had, because I think you can draw a direct line between what Annie Hall wore in the movie, what Diane Keaton wore in Annie
Hall. Just remind us of her costume for those who are saying,
The most famous, she wore khaki trousers, wide khaki trousers, and she wore a white shirt, a black waistcoat with a tie and a hat.
Yeah.
Right? And I think you can draw a direct line between Annie Hall and Phoebe in Friends. Similar personalities and the costumes.
And definitely. In fact, the clip that I'm about to play gives a sense of that as well. Diane Keaton says, the scene where we first meet her in Annie Hall, wearing the iconic outfit that you're talking about there, and an iconic line which she improvised herself.
Oh, well. La-di-da, la-di-da, la-la, yeah.
You want a lift?
Oh, why? You got a car?
No, I was going to take a cab.
Oh, no, I have a car.
You have a car? So, I don't understand. If you have a car, so then why did you say, do you have a car, like you wanted a lift?
I don't know. I wasn't. I got this VW out there. What a jerk, yeah.
Diane Keaton as Annie Hall there, and of course Woody Allen in the midst of that as well. We've been talking a lot about the costumes that women wear. Men wear costumes too, and presumably they have designers. Are we in a similar type of thing? Classic chic, or worn out and worn down?
Well, the thing is that unless the movie's set in the past, like The Great Gatsby.
Yeah.
Okay. You're not going to really have a costume designer specifically as ostentatious or as opulent as a woman would have. But I think there's two or three costumes designs that for me really, really stand out. The first one would be obviously James Dean from Rebel Without a Cause, with his red Harrington jacket, white T-shirt and denim jeans. But for me, the important thing there is everyone ascribes Dean as setting the template. But Marlon Brando had set the template four years previously with A Streetcar Named Desire, wearing the T-shirt.
Yeah.
Okay. Now, just as an aside, Blanche DuBois in the movie is played by Vivien Leigh, who'd actually played in Gone with the Wind. And in the play, she very famously says, "I want magic, I want magic." And what she gets is Stanley Kowalski, who's this very, very greased up, grubby, sweaty guy who comes in with a T-shirt and jeans, rips off the T-shirt, glistening torso underneath, puts on a new one. And then he tears it up. And again, that's reflective of character.
How developed now is costume design? It's as integral a part of any film, I guess, as any other aspect. The lighting, the sound design, all of those things.
Yeah, I think though today, the direction that I point the audience in is towards animation. okay? Because you've got code writers and are creating programs that render different fabrics and textures, and how the costumes will react as the characters move. So if you think about the traditional hand-drawn animation, you know, Cinderella and Snow White, and then compare it to Encanto or Frozen, you've got a completely different rendering of fashion and clothes.
Which brings us right to where you started in some ways when you talked about Edna Mode from The Incredibles, whose appearance you told us about, based on the famed designer Edith Head. Big round glasses and bob hairstyle and sounding like this.
I never look back, darling. It distracts from the now. You need a new suit. That much is certain.
A new suit? Oh, where the heck am I going to get a new
suit? You can't! It's impossible! I'm far too busy, so ask me now before I again become sane.
Wait, you want to make me a suit?
No, you push too hard, darling, but I accept. It will be bold, dramatic, heroic.
Yeah, something classic, like Dinah Guy. Oh, he had a great look. Oh, the cape and the boots.
No capes!
The Incredibles there, and Stephen Benedict speaking to us about costume design in the movies. And so to our album reviews on this Friday evening, One Direction, first up, is but a distant memory in the career of Harry Styles. He returns with his third solo album. Former boy band star has matured into one of the most respected pop stars of his generation, it could be said. Latest album is called Harry's House. Next up, Soak. You might have heard our interview with Soak on Wednesday evening show. They joined us to talk about their new album. Musical moniker of singer-songwriter Bridie Mons Watson. Their new album is called If I Never Know You Like This Again. And finally, Dublin-based brothers Diarmaid and Brian McGlynn, professionally known as Ye Vagabonds, back with album number 3 as well. And it's called Nine Waves, previous winners of the RTE Best Folk Group. And this year they are accompanied by the Crash Ensemble and others. Kate Brennan-Harding is in Galway. Dave Hanratty is with me here in studio. They've both been listening. Let's start with the global pop sensation that is Harry Styles' new album, Harry's House. And this is how it starts.
Bubblegum twister anytime. I don't want you to get lost. I don't want you to go broke. I want you.
It's cause I love you, babe. In every kind of way. Just a little taste.
That's the sort of music that should be played in a sushi restaurant, according to Harry Styles. Music for a sushi restaurant, the opening track on his new album, Harry's House. Kate Brennan-Harding and Dave Hanratty, as I said, are our reviewers on this Friday evening. Kate, third highly anticipated album from Harry Styles. We need to talk about Harry, I think. Very loyal fan base, and I think you are a member of SAME, are you?
I am absolutely a bona fide member. I am, membership bought and paid for a long time ago. And I have been really looking forward to this album since I watched his performance at Coachella a few weeks ago. And this album does not disappoint. And I only got the record companies were like, no, you can't listen to it. So we actually only got to listen to it from this morning. And I've been listening to it on repeat, blasting it out my window. And I think that starts... Music for a sushi restaurant. It just lifts you. It's glorious. I love it. It's fun. And it's got shades of Paul Simon going on and a bit of Prince, and it's just absolute happiness. And I think this entire album is wrapped up in happiness and smooth sex appeal. It's brilliant.
And David, we were saying as we were listening to it, that big band, big brass sound going on in the background. There's lots happening here. Are you a member of the loyal fan base?
Well, first of all, let's be honest here, Sean. We weren't just listening to it. We were bopping to it.
This is true.
The track is absolutely huge. As I was at 7 in the morning this morning, I was on my shift, and I was like, yeah, because as Kate says, we didn't have access to it until today. So that is a bit of a caveat. Am I a member of the fan base? I think I might be now. I will say I have struggled a bit with Harry Styles in as much as... I found the idea of him more interesting than the execution in the kind of post One Direction era, because like the first record was very much a karaoke album. He was trying on all kinds of different styles. Now he's still doing that now, 3 albums in, but it's finally worn me down and won me over. And I do find him, Kate kind of alluded to it. I mean, like, he's a very interesting guy, and he's a socially kind of conscientious guy. I think he's been very savvy with his fan base. I think he's says all the right things, has made all the right moves. But the tunes are here, and I have to say I've been very much enjoying this on the 10 or so listens I've crowbarred into over the last 12 hours.
Okay, he says all the right things, he makes all the right moves, and he's very conscientious guy. He's a guy. Let's listen to a track called Boyfriends.
Weekend, when you get deep in, he starts secretly drinking. It gets hard to know what he's thinking. You love a fool who knows just how to get under your skin.
Now there you go. You're in love with a fool who knows just how to get under your skin. Very sincere. There used to be an old saying that, you know, oh, I'm just misunderstood, and it was a great line for the bad boyfriend to use, Kate Brennan Harding. But here, no, it's not that you're misunderstood. It's if you're a boyfriend, you're misunderstanding your partner in the process of this. He's singing, he's playing to the gallery there, isn't he?
He's playing to the gallery, but also, like, he's, you know, talking about his cousins and his sister and having conversations with them about boyfriends. And, you know, there's something very poignant and beautiful about this track. I've listened to it over and over, and I do think at the moment it's my favourite track on the album, and there's a lot of favourites, but I think it shows a different sensibility to him as well. It's got a gorgeous country edge. I'd love to hear him duet this. I really would. I'd love to hear him with Miley Cyrus. I think their vocals would be perfect with this. But like, in terms of playing to the gallery, he's also, you know, he's not afraid to just, he's not labelled. He's just singing about something that he sees people experiencing. And he does come across as really authentic. There's nothing, I don't think there's anything fake about Harry Styles.
Okay. I must be the only cynic in the room. Then, I can see you're kind of nodding in agreement with Kate there. Boy Brand, I saw him referred to somewhere today. Is that unfair as well, Dave?
No, yeah. That's not unfair at all. He is very savvy, and like, again, I would have been right there with you, maybe even on the last album, but he has kind of won me over in that I don't think it's an act. I do think it's genuine. It is a smart career move, but he has come out and made statements like, you know, he's like, we shouldn't underestimate the intelligence of teenage girls, you know, like why do we do this?
Yeah.
He's positioned himself as an avatar for more vulnerable kind of members, like a kind of queer youth as well. He's been kind of cagey about his own sexuality, which is of course without question his right, and he's been pushed on it by journalists. It's a bit of a lazy thing. But he stands up there as a conscientious young man, as I said before, in this kind of day and age. And whether he is doing it to kind of, you know, be cynical or not, I don't think he is, but it works. It works one way or another. And a song like this, it's a bit drippy, fair enough. I think the strongest points of it kind of remind me actually of All People of De Laurentiis, off kind of one of their tracks, Off Night Becomes Light. There are moments in this record where he strays into kind of Sheeran territory. He does dip away from the kind of the big booming pop. But when he's on, he's on. And I do think he's been on more often than off, especially even like, Kate mentioned the Coachella performance there at the top of this. That was unbelievable. Like, the crowd that was at that performance are louder than him, louder than the production. Yeah, it's Beatlemania.
I saw a link today where you can hear nothing but the crowd, which is, as you say, it's Beatlemania. All right. Clearly a bona fide a member of the Harry Styles fan club now, Dave Hanratty. Stars from you first, Dave.
Again, with the caveat of I've only had one day to listen to this so far, so I do feel uncomfortable putting a score on anything after this amount of time. But unlike the Kendrick Lamar album last week, it is a bit more palatable to unpack. All that said, 3.5 out of 5 at this point.
3.5 out of 5 at this point, but 3.5 and growing, it sounds like to me.
Ask me in a week.
All right, so the little caveat there. Kate, I don't think, are there any caveats in your opinion on this one?
None, because I am a terrible person for making snap decisions on music, and sometimes a year later I discover I'm wrong. But with this, to me, it dips a little bit in the middle, but I think I was just so upbeat from the first three songs, which are really brilliant. You know, they're just gorgeous. He has a Ferry-esque, a Brian Ferry kind of quality to him, I think, which is what I absolutely love. I'm giving it 4 out of 5. I think it's absolutely brilliant, and I think he's the pop star we need.
All right. Very clear there. Harry's House from Harry Styles, 3.5 and 4 respectively. Let's move on then to Brady Munns Watson. Derry from Derry, known to music fans as Soak, has been much praised since their debut album in 2015, won the Choice Music Prize. The new album is called If I Never Know You Like This. Let's have a listen to a track called Last July.
And you saw in my extended daydreams, if now's not a good time, bury me in last July.
July, the title of that track from the album If I Never Know You Like This Again from Soak. Kate, I spoke to them on the programme earlier in the week and I touched on this idea that they themselves have said, this is the album, if you want to get close to me, if you want to hear who I am, then you're going to hear it on this album. I would have said they've always been quite self-analytical, always been quite open about themselves. Has something changed on album number three, do you think?
Completely. It's a second coming of age, so to speak. The first two albums are fantastic. I've been a fan of Brighties for ages. But the main thing around this album is they're stepping into themselves hugely. And I was listening to that interview you had with them the other day. Soak has... They were in Brighton and they were creating this album in a basement. I love the idea of this, in a basement, which was a massage parlour that wasn't in operation in the pandemic in yeah. Brighton. They just moved there and started experimenting more with sounds. And then basically, I think, was given permission to completely express themselves. And I think you hear a confidence and a self-assured confidence. I think stepping into their skin, into the non-binary world as well has facilitated that. And I think then there's a lot of this album is coming together where, you know, they spoke before about the musicians joining up again and the joy that came from being able to play these songs after creating them. So for me, this is exactly what Soak said. It's like another debut album.
Yeah. And there was such a weight of expectation in their teens when that debut album was released, and this whole idea, oh, this is the future of Irish music, was the phrase that was bandied around so much. How have they managed to navigate that level of expectation, do you think, Dave?
I'd say with a quiet confidence that has grown over time. I mean, I may very well have been one of those journalists who put that expectation or pressure on. I saw Brighty perform at Independence back in about 2013, I think, and I was just so impressed by this kid. I was like, who are they? And they have been telling us who they are over the course of these three albums. It's an evolution of a sound. It's a bigger sound. I mean, sonically, it kind of takes me back to the 90s, actually, of all things, which I'm always up for.
I completely agree.
Yeah, which is great, because it's like you have that thing of like, it sounds a bit like No Doubt, and then it sounds a bit like Sheryl Crow. But of course, there are modern touchstones as well. Soccer Mommy, Pillow Queens, Snail Mail as well. But I mean, it's interesting because it seems that so often we see album press releases that say, this is the album I always wanted to make. And I usually kind of recoil at that.
Yeah.
It's a bit of a cliche, but here I think it's earned.
It's
and
true.
I think yeah. it genuinely is. And I mean, I read an interview that they did in Totally Dublin this week and talking about how after shows recently, fans came up and talked about their own experiences and their own kind of, you know, as you know, Kate references, like non-binary queerness and like how someone like Soak is now an avatar for them
yeah.
and a role
yeah.
model. And while they may not have always wanted to be one, I think they are doing it incredibly well.
Yeah.
And it is backed up with the music on this record.
And now, both of you have spoken about the big sound of the 90s, so you mightn't be happy with the second track that I want to play. I just love this. I don't know what it's about other than that it's about a heartbreak and that it's beautiful. It's called Bleach.
Bleach.
Just a taste there of the track Bleach from Soak's new album, If I Never Know You Like This Again. Kate, that song goes on to talk about getting used to being to my own company, and then I get the smell, I get your smell on my clothes. It's so sensual, and yes, that big sound is in there that you both spoke about, but we're getting the singer-songwriter that we know and love in Soak and that song as well.
We are, and that song is actually about their partner going away for a trip to Japan and Soak's insecurities around their partner maybe finding love somewhere else. And, you know, it's very much written again. We're talking about the non-binary thing. It was very much written again about the insecurities around maybe not being enough and, you know, also that longing and that love when somebody leaves you. And it's a really beautiful track. I'm glad you played it, actually,
yeah.
because
Good.
I've been carried away with the bigger songs and with the jangly kind
yeah.
of guitar tracks and everything, but it's really gorgeous.
Yeah, if I'd had another half hour on earlier in the week, that would have been one of the songs I would have chosen to play as well.
Totally.
However, Kate, from you, stars for Soak and If I Never Know You Like This Again.
Well, this is the thing. So I keep wrestling with this. I've been listening to this album and I've fallen completely in love with this album over the last number of weeks. I've been very lucky to listen to it for a long time. I'm going to give it 4.5 out of 5. I think it's masterful, and I think that it's going to elevate Soak to another level, which is brilliant.
Okay, and what are you saying, Dave?
It's 3.5 for me, although, I mean, even this conversation kind of moves me closer to a 4. I'm being a bit pedantic. I think on occasion, kind of gets stuck in its own lane and kind of with that throwback sound, which I know is being contradicted because I do like it, but I just wonder if there's a slight repetition to this one. But for now, 3.5.
For now, 3.5, but keeping the door open.
Absolutely.
Soak and If I Never Know You Like This Again. Final album this evening, 9 Waves from Ye Vagabonds. Let's have a listen to a bit of a track called Lord Gregory.
The wind beats my yellow locks, the dew adds my skin, the baby's cold in my arms, Lord Gregory, let me in. Lord Gregory's not here, nor henceforth can't be seen. He is gone to bonny Scotland to bring home his new queen. So leave now these windows and likewise this hall, for it's deep in the sea you should hide your downfall.
Taste there of Lord Gregory, third song, in fact, on the new album from Ye Vagabonds, 9 Waves. The brothers here, it's all there in that song, and it's there in several songs across the album, Kate. The trademark vocals, their voices blend together in an extraordinary type of way, and, you know, straightforward, simple string accompaniments.
They really do. And the thing is that what makes them, that obviously the brothers are incredibly special. And this is a gorgeous collection of songs they've written themselves and then their own takes on, you know, past folk songs, exactly like Lord Gregory, which is, you know, a song that I believe has been recorded like 150 times or something like that. But the guys also pair up with a really good producer who deserves a mention, John Spud Murphy, who produces Lancome. And I think they all combine, especially after the pandemic, they combined and they've brought us into the only way I can describe it. There's a song called The Island on it, and it's exactly like entering an island, an island of their world. And it's really intricate. Crash Ensemble are a part of it. Cormac Begley is a part of it. There's really, really stunning musicianship throughout. And again, their vocals, and they're, sometimes they're tender and sometimes they're raucous. It's really beautiful.
Yeah, I wanted more of that Crash Ensemble, Cormac Begley type of mix into it, because when it's just the two of them, it's perfectly lovely to listen to. But that little experimental side is quite interesting too, Dave.
Yeah, I kind of wanted this to be a bit darker all around, really. I mean, it's interesting because, I mean, like, John Spud Murphy absolutely does deserve a call out. He's doing imperious work. And it's almost impossible not to mention Lancome in the same breath as Ye Vagabonds. I kind of think of Lancome as the devil on the shoulder to Ye Vagabonds as angel. I had a strange experience with this album because, like, I'm glad Kate mentioned An Island. It's an absolutely stunning piece of music. It's a gorgeous, gorgeous song. And it arrives very early into this one. So for this one, it kind of peaked early for me, but it peaked in a very, very strange way. I was walking home the other night and it was kind of the last embers of a dying sun, and it was just a very nice Monday evening, and just for a second everything kind of stopped as I was listening to the song, and just the refrain in it at the end of alone and together is all that will ever be, it really, really hit me. And I mean I don't want to get overly personal here, but like, I lost my father at the start of the year, and this was a song for just a split second I felt like he was with me again, and then he was gone again, and it was that thing of like, it was just that magical moment that music can sometimes do for you. Yeah. And in that moment, I was just very, very grateful for what they'd put together.
Oh, that's a lovely, lovely way to look at it, Dave. And alone and all together, alone and together is all that we'll ever be. That song, Kate, it was written by one of the brothers in isolation during lockdown. And sharing it with his brother, with the other brother, was a real moment of fear.
Yeah, so I read a few bits about them, and Dermot had been sitting at the same window, looking out at the same, you know, the same birds, the same thing every day, and had written it, and it was quite different. And only when they were reunited in March 2021, Brian sang the words back, and they have this lovely description of it being like an open guitar. So I can imagine what that sound is like. And suddenly, oh, the song makes complete sense. And that song is definitely one of the highlights of the album. But like, there's some beautiful little bits where you're just suddenly,
I think one of those is, like, can I just want to play a little bit of it, which is the opening section, a thing called Tuam. There's
Tuam,
one
that's
further
what I was
down
gonna say. Yeah.
Called Fuam. Let's have a listen to what they do. It's only 40 seconds. Yeah, I just wanted to get a taste of it in there, Kate. It is, they set up this lovely, and I'd loved more of that kind of loose experimental feel across the tracks as well.
Yeah, I know what you're saying, but what I love is that those kind of experimental moments wash over and around the two singers. So it's like we are on the island with them, you know?
Yeah, okay, stars from you, Kate.
I'm giving it 4 out of 5. I really enjoyed it, and I can't wait to see them play live somewhere in a lovely kind of place in the country.
And Div?
Yeah, it's a 3. I think it's a bit too beholden to its own narrative. It is an album of moments, and the moments that are here can be incredible, but at times I just felt a little bit of sameness.
All right, that's Dave Henry and Kate Brennan Harding. 3 albums that we're speaking about this evening: 9 Waves from Ye Vagabonds, If I Never Know You Like This Again from Soak, and Harry's House from Harry Styles, bringing us to the end of this week's Arena.